the next panel. So my name is Shauna Ghosh. I'm from the law firm Hill Dickinson. I'm going to be moderating the next panel. Our topic this morning is navigating global trade and commerce, with a specific focus on regulations, economic, and geopolitical issues. It's really a rather broad topic. There's been, I think, some overlap with some of the panels this morning on the regulatory side. But we'll try our best to dissect these topics, and we hope you'll find it useful. So I'll start off with introducing my panel. So to the left of me, I have Renee Pedersen. Renee is the Managing Director of AP Moller Singapore Private Limited. They own and operate more than 120 container vessels. Renee has significant experience in business development, government relations, in the transport, logistics, and infrastructure sectors, and has worked all over the world. Renee is currently the Vice President of the Singapore Shipping Association. Next to Renee, we've got Ashima. Ashima leads the Maritime Safety, Sustainability, and Technical Team at BHP. She's responsible for a team of experts who set BHP's global maritime safety standards and who have the technical skill set required to work with 150 vessels on the water at any time. Her team is also responsible for BHP's global decarbonization agenda. Next to Ashima, we've got Emma. Emma is the head of CITIS Maritime's Finance and Treasury Division, leading finance initiatives, including M&A. The company owns and controls a fleet of 50 to 60 vessels at any given time, and they focus on minor bulk commodities across global trade routes. Next to Emma, we've got Gunnar. Gunnar is the chief financial officer of Gram Car Carriers, and they manage 22 car carriers. And last but not least, we've got Marco. Marco is the CEO of Premuda. Premuda is a leading provider of dry cargo and tanker services globally, currently controlling a fleet of 28 vessels. So quite a diverse panel, mostly owner-focused, but different types of ships, and then also, I suppose, Ashima, more charter-focused. So we'll delve right in, starting off with the regulatory aspect. So regulatory uncertainty is a consistently highly rated risk in our industry. I think in Lloyd's List surveys, even up until 2021, it was the highest ranked risk. It's still up there. The pace of change and the technical nature of maritime environmental regulations enhance these risks. So I think it would be interesting to hear from you all on how standards are being implemented and what the continuing challenges are. So maybe we can first start with Renee. Maybe we could focus on regulations towards decarbonization, the IMO 2023 regulations. What has been your experience navigating these issues?
Thank you, Shauna. And thank you to Capital Link for having me here today. It's a rather big subject, and I understand this morning there has also been talked a lot about decarb and alternative fuels, etc. I think it's obvious for everyone that there's a challenge in respect of decarbonizing this industry. I come from Maersk, and in Maersk we are fully committed to be a part of the solution rather than being a part of the problem. Our ambition is to be fully decarbonized by 2040, and that means that I cannot procrastinate on that challenge. The vessels I order today need to be a part of the solution, not only today, but also in 2040. We have taken delivery of our first green methanol vessels, the first one we took delivery of quarter three last year, and as late as last week we received yet another 16,000 TU green methanol vessel. The big challenge here is not necessarily to order the vessels. We have locked in orders for around 25 methanol vessels, and if you look across the industry, it's more than 150 vessels that are on order. So it's not only us; it's the entire industry which is a part of the solution here. The big challenge is really to source fuel. Just now, green methanol is priced at 3, maybe even 4x, and there we have a challenge. So how do we close this gap? And Shana talked about regulatory risk. I may actually talk about regulatory opportunity. When we turn to IMO, here we have a global body that can regulate our industry and help in closing the gap. And that is something which are being discussed. Those of you who joined the opening of Singapore Maritime Week yesterday would probably have heard the GenSec of IMO talking about the decisions taken in recent meetings. This is a good step forward, but it doesn't end there. We have to continue this work. In World Shipping Council, we have introduced what we call green balancing mechanism. It's basically a mechanism where we even the price between green fuels and fossil fuels. So I don't want to hijack the agenda because I could probably talk for the full 40 minutes, but it's not only about regulatory risk, and especially when you look to IMO, it's also about regulatory opportunity. Thank you.
Ashima, you set and push BHP's decarbonization agenda. So how do you approach regulatory issues from your position as charterer?
So thanks, Shana. I think, you know, in my team specifically, we're very interested in regulation from a safety perspective and as well as from a decarbonization perspective. And I think, you know, one thing as an industry that we're grappling with is that the ubiquity of fuel oil as the main source of fuel for shipping, and just based on cost and efficiency, is no longer the case. And that we're moving from a world of, you know, that homogenous one type of fuel, one type of tank, to a world of many different kinds of options, many different types of fuels. And I think it is important to have regulation as a bit of a baseline that the industry can align on. And I think what happened last year, particularly with the IMO 2023 targets that were set, really helped to establish that baseline and bring the industry onto the same page with regards to these are the things we need to do to hit our 2030 targets, to hit our 2050 targets. So as a charterer, we welcome regulation where it promotes alignment and collaboration across the ecosystem, where multiple parties, be it as charterers, as bunkering companies, as vessel owners, we all work towards the same goal and target. From BHP's perspective, we are the world's largest bulk charterer, so we do feel that we have a responsibility to kind of create that demand. However, we cannot create that demand without the appropriate regulations in place. So where one of our pillars of our decarbonization strategy is to consider alternate fuels, we cannot bring that into our fleet mix unless the right safety frameworks are in place, the crew competency frameworks, the technological readiness is in place. And all of this is facilitated with the right regulation that would be put in place.
Thanks very much. Emma. Perhaps you could tell us a bit more about your experience in managing regulations such as the CII in the EU Emissions Trading Scheme. In particular, you know, how have these regulations impacted the way you've been able to raise finance?
Thanks, Shana. So for us at CITES, it's, in our view, it's a question of enforcement rather than implementation. The frameworks in their current iteration, they're there. We're monitoring against them, we're reporting against them. But what's not clear to us as a ship owner and an operator is how these will really be enforced. So if we take CII as an example, we're expected to have ratings. And if we have an E rating, we are supposed to submit a plan by April with actions to improve the rating. But what's unclear to us is how the class will enforce, how they'll enforce this plan and what that will mean for us as an owner. So I think there's still quite a lot of ambiguity there in that space. The same applies to EU ETS. I mean, being very close to it on the ground, we're seeing that owners and operators are still very much figuring out EU ETS, ourselves included. I mean, from a practical perspective, we're seeing that most owners are not even set up to trade EUAs. We're receiving cash settlement in lieu of EUAs. So it just kind of speaks of the lack of readiness across our segment. There's also, as somebody mentioned on a panel earlier today, the cost implication. So there is that sleeping cost of the extra administration, the bookkeeping, that really kind of becomes very heavy for smaller ship owners like we are. Your specific question was around financing. For us, we've not really seen a material impact, given that we undertook a material fleet renewal over the last couple of years. So 75% of our fleet is now considered eco, so financing those vessels was easier and it was cheaper. Mm-hmm. But for those that aren't in the same position, I would expect there would obviously be a significant incremental cost.
Thanks, Emma. Gunnar, so has your experience been sort of largely similar? I mean, you would see quite a lot of carriage of EVs. Do you see any sort of regulations from that aspect that affects your company?
I think firstly on the CII or the IMO regulations, we're a slightly smaller company than René's company, but we have 18 ships on the water. So we've been working very closely with DNV and Emissions Connect to simulate how our vessels are performing and so on, and devising a decarbonization plan for each individual vessel, and working with our charters. We time charter out our vessel as a tonnage provider. So, it's a dynamic thing we have to work on continuously. Be interesting to see how the use of biofuels play out, the price of biofuels. Working closely with our customers on this. And, of course, the ratings are going to be important to follow, and making plans where necessary. On EV, you mentioned lithium batteries. I mean, there's not much new regulation, but there's been some incidents, so we're working very closely with the charters again on procedures and so forth to make sure that fire safety is the highest standard. In terms of procedure, the EVs, like when ice cars with you have petrol on the tank, and of course that's a hazardous waste, and similarly with the EVs, the state of charge on the batteries of the cars that you take on board on ro-ro vessels, mm-hmm, need to be minimized, and there's being a lot of work being done on improving fire safety.
Right.
So, but not so much on regulation.
Right, I understand. Marco, do you have anything to add? I mean, maybe you can tell us, whether, you've changed. Do you see a change in approach to regulations over time so that you can, we're now more proactive than reactive to things that are coming in?
Thank you very much for asking me this question. Look, I think proactive and reactive. I think we come from a world that seemed to be so far away and was just 10, 15 years ago, but I think it's totally different chapter. So today, I think you can't be in any field, and especially in shipping, without being proactive. You have a continuous change of regulations, but also of business practices, trade flows. You have to be very much proactive. Because if you tend to react, you're going to be always to a later response, which is not going to be good for your business. I think that in a lot of things, for example, we're talking about the certificates of the European, the EUTS. It's a very complicated issue because we are dealing with people as tonnage providers, but also as charterers in, with people that are from different nationalities, different parts of the world, who have no idea, they really have no clue of what's going on in our part of the world. Mm-hmm. So you have, there is a big phase of explaining why you have to do this. So I think that sometimes this little bit patchwork of regulation is not very... conducive to this smooth conduct of your business. Sometimes I think, and probably a lot of people would disagree with me, that probably would be better to have one global directive, and at least everybody knows exactly what it is, and now this applies to Europe, this applies to this, this applies to that, you know. I think we make it also more complicated than it has to be, but I think that's human nature, so that we tend to make our life more miserable than what we need actually to do. I think this patchwork of regulation has been very, very, very complicated. I don't know, that, a little bit, that's my comment on this. Renee, I'm sure you have something to say about that.
No bite from Renee.
No bite from Renee.
No. Right. Would anybody else like to just jump in there with sort of your approach in these times? You know, how it's changed. It must be quite challenging to react. I mean, there's the pace of change is one thing, and then the complexity is also there.
Shana, the geopolitical issue, I think, is what's fascinating. I think we all come from a world that we saw some things like a given, especially these days are happening things in the Middle East, which have been continuously happening, but today they're there, I think, to a new level. You know, and people, you know, and but the world has really changed. If 25 years ago you told me that Iran is a tough position with Western countries, I would say that probably they would block the straits, and then the United States and other Western nations would be their best interest to break up this blockade. But today, at the end of the day, what comes out of the Gulf, it's probably minimal part of what goes to a lot of Western countries. Well, it's probably more interest of the Indian and the Chinese to keep their route open, than no longer the Americans or the Europeans. I think there's been a total shift, so alliances have been changing, and therefore also paths of trade have been dramatically changing. I think today, you know, some countries have taken enormous importance and some others have lost a lot of importance. So I think it's a little bit our feeling for we are in this business to see how to adapt to this very fast-changing world, because the change is very radical and very fast, you know. I think.
So turning to the geopolitics then, so what has been sort of the biggest challenge for you, Marco, then, in the last few years?
Well, you know, first of all, you had this issue about Russia, which we don't go to Russia for several reasons, among them not even cap business, period. We don't go to Russia because most of our ships are Italian flagged, and so Italy has been a little bit in a tough position with Russia, so we didn't want to have any issues with our crews being blocked there. Second of all, we're part of a fund that's a U.S. fund, so we really didn't want to have anything to do with Russia. But also there, the messages have always been mixed. I don't know who's familiar a little bit with the tanker business. So you get this message, say, no more trade with Russia. Then comes the next message, no more trade with Russia if the oil is above the cap. Okay. Then you get a call from the Treasury Department of the United States saying, yes, but please try and do the cap business with Russia, because otherwise there's going to be a shortage of oil coming out of Russia and prices are going to go up, and this is not good for inflation. Mm-hmm. So everybody's trying, you know, you're trying to put really a round peg in a square hole, and it gets very, very complicated because everybody says the story they want, you know. And this, what I told you, has been a constant message. Yes, we want to enforce some sanctions to Russia, but we still need the Russian oil. So please trade with the Russian oil below the cap, which becomes then you have to do all your KYC, which you as a lawyer would appreciate that as a bonanza, you know, who belongs to that. This ship has done transshipment with that ship. So it's becoming really very, very complicated. You know, I think it used to be a much simpler world, and probably we overcomplicate. We'll be simpler. Let's not trade with Russia. But then somebody says, okay, but we still need their oil, otherwise we have running inflation if oil goes up. So, you know, this is very difficult.
Mm. I mean, I'm sure the rest of you have, other issues as well that perhaps you could talk about that, you've dealt with and how you've dealt with them over the last few years. We'll start with...
I'll chip in quickly. Yeah. I mean, I guess geopolitical conflict is definitely live. And what's interesting is in the job that we do every day, we come in, we're reading the news, and we're sitting down and saying, what are the controls that we need to put in place to ensure that we are not impacted? With regards to, with the conflict escalating late last year, our, main focus, and this was brought up earlier today, was also around deviation, right? Getting out of the danger zone, avoiding the high-risk areas. But the conflict is escalating to the extent, very interestingly, I was just sitting in a discussion yesterday where we're like, if this escalates, what is the range of the missiles? So we're not just talking about the Middle East now. We're talking about even when you look towards India. Mm. And for BHP, a lot of our trade is happening on that, Australia to China route. So we can control, we can put controls in place, but it creates a very, very volatile situation to the point that there are very unique trades that one needs to understand what are the controls that are going to be necessary, because the crisis can escalate in many different ways. And then it, of course, has a commercial impact as well, and how that commercial impact is shared between charterer, vessel owner, the customer as well. Volatile, interesting, and something that we navigate on a daily basis.
Yeah, I think we are all facing the same complexity here. We have geopolitics has changed. It impacts trade flows. We start to see that nations are trading in a different way. We also see when we go to our clients, our customers, that they are rewiring their global supply chains. Try not to be too dependent on one geography, but diversify their sourcing. We see a security disruption. We see it directly in the Black Sea, in the Red Sea. Actually, we saw an MSC vessel being stopped by a foreign government, by Iran, a few days back. It's something new. It's not something we normally see in our industry. Then we have disruption from climate change, and it's not just something happening 60 or 80 years from now. This year, last year, we experienced that the water levels in the Panama Canal was very low. That impacted our industry and many other, or our segment and other segments directly. So I think there's a lot to manage as a transport and logistics and shipping company these days. But I think we should also remember that if you look back, for those of you who have been for many years in the industry, we have always had disruptions. We always had incidents. But there's no doubt, just now it seems that it's adding up, adding up somehow. And of course, what we find especially concerning is that this deteriorating political ability to solve conflicts peacefully, that's of course a huge concern.
Thanks.
You know, on this subject, I'm sorry if I'm... but this is, it goes through everything, I'm noticing. You know, also on the debate about future fuels, you know, I think there is a lack of simplicity, and there is also a lack of realism among people. So everybody now is saying we have 2050, zero emission, but then nobody says that with a clear plan. So we're talking about 2050, and there is not even an agreement in the world about what's going to be the future fuel of the world. And then is it the whole process of that fuel a green process? Because honestly, I totally disagree of saying let's change to methanol when you use coal probably to produce electricity. You know, there's a lot of non-correct assumption in the whole thing. And then we're thinking, still debating if it's going to be methanol, if it's going to be nuclear, if it's going to be ammonia, if it's going to be LNG. LNG seemed to be the talk of the town. Then we discovered that there is this methane slip, and methane is 10 times worse than CO2. You know, it's really very amateurish, all of this. And we're just dabbling around, forgetting that the industry that we represent, it is what everybody, transporting what everybody needs. I think 95% of all the objects we have, that we touch during the day, at one point or another have been on board of a ship. So we're all dabbling with something that is so key and so important, forgetting also that the cost is important, because let's say we increase the cost because we're going to move to another fuel. But increased cost is going to mean that it has a certain inflation impact. An inflation impact is going to mean that certain governments won't be able to lower interest rates in a moment where everybody's screaming around the world that interest rates have to go down. So it is everything connected. Mm. But we forget really to connect the dots, and we make everything much more complicated, I think. I think we should be more realistic, you know. For example, on the fuels, how can you think about converting to alternative fuels smaller ships like Handys that go in probably 2,000 ports in the world, and in each of those ports you should have a methanol reservoir, an ammonia reservoir, an LNG reservoir. The logistics of these things are enormous, and people really discount them, you know, so this is what's going to happen. And then we find ourselves dabbling in the dark, and we're doing damages to what we need in the world, because we need ships every day to carry the things that we need. Look during COVID what happened, you know. So I think there's a lot of unrealism and lack of accepting things for what they are, I think, a little bit.
Yeah. I mean,
but I'm very politically incorrect saying this, but, you know, but I have white hair and I can afford it, so, you know.
No, but the interconnectedness of everything now cannot be understated. I completely agree.
If I may, I fully agree. It's complicated to green our industry. But not doing it, not doing an effort, not leaning out and into the problem, that's not a solution. So I can definitely point to all the challenges and the problems, but that's only by facing it and dealing with it that we'll come up with long-term solutions. And I think we cannot afford that our industry are looked at as someone who is not a part of the solution. This industry has been around for several hundred years in the form and the shape we know it today. We have always been a part of the solution. You look to COVID, we were a part of the solution. We have been going from shale to steam to fossil fuels, and we can also move on to green fuels. I strongly believe in that. And the day I don't believe in it, I don't believe in a future of this industry, and I think that would be wrong.
René, totally agree with you, but I'm not saying it's not a solution, but I say let's do things logically. So today we're still debating if eco non-eco. So first step number one would be let's bring all the ship of the fleet of the world into an eco position. That would be already a step forward. Mm-hmm. Then from there we can start moving forward. Here you have ships that are 25 years old, still running around the planet, and then we're thinking on the other hand of other countries implementing ammonia or LNG. So I think let's do it by logical steps. First of all, let's move into eco ships. Then, and not first, you know, we have some eco ships, we have a lot of non-eco ships, but it's my plan to move to next step of moving to eco, because I think that's the least we can do, and that's what I want to do, because I think we owe it to ourselves, we owe it to the industry, and we owe it to our fellow citizens of the world. But just putting too many things on the dish together, I don't think it's very confusing.
I still think it's possible.
Yeah, it's so, possible. You but know where it's possible. I'll tell you where it's possible. Because you at Maersk, you have a balance sheet that you order 10 wrong ships, you can take the hit. For a smaller owner, he orders 10 wrong ships with the wrong fuel thing, he closes. And so, you know, I think also size has a certain size.
Of course. But actually, you see smaller ship owners in the container segment who is also making these bets. So... I don't want to make this into a huge discussion, but I just think we need to address the problem, and addressing the challenges and the issues or talking about them, it's not enough. We need to be a part of the solution, and I think we owe this to our industry and to the rest of the world.
Yeah, I understand, but you know, becoming part of the problem by having financial problems is not issuing the solving the solution. You know, so I think. But anyhow.
I'm just going to move on because we've only got 9.5 minutes.
You wanted a lively panel. Here, I'm giving you one.
Right. Just still on geopolitics. I mean, sort of, I was reading something that described sort of the state of our world as being in a state of stabilized volatility is the term that was used. And things seem to be moving quite quickly all the time. It's like what you said earlier, Renee. We've always faced challenges, but it's everything more and more at once. This year is referred to as sort of the election year. We've got many, many countries. Of course, the U.S., their EU elections. I think I came across sort of, it says about more than 60 countries this year holding elections. Is this something that features sort of, does it feature in sort of your planning? Is it a consideration for you? What do you do to de-risk or increase resilience to changes that come about or may come about from such elections, policy changes?
You want me to start?
Oh, no. Maybe we can start with Emma.
Yes, sure. No problem. Marco and Renee, yeah. I'll get a word in edgeways. Yeah. So I think there's some hard de-risk measures that we will take at CETUS as an example. We don't trade the Red Sea. And in light of the recent escalations, it looks as though we made the right decision, and we won't trade that area until there is a significant de-escalation. But then there's the kind of increased resilience measures that we've taken, and those aren't necessarily in terms of hard lines, but they are kind of longer, more strategic actions. We've strengthened our balance sheet. We've significantly reduced our LTVs. We've reduced our cash break-even, so that means we are resilient to certain geopolitical mm-hmm. or economic events that may crop up on the future, certainly from a financial perspective. As Marco said, being a smaller scale ship owner with, while a strong balance sheet, not the size of Maersk's, to fall back on should anything, should we have face another protracted downturn. I also think, given our segment, or my sub-segment, which is handy size, and our focus on minor bulks, we have a little bit of inherent resilience as well. So as we see the U.S. elections coming up, and I think we are all expecting the worst outcome, and that will lean towards a further decoupling of U.S. and China relations, further allegiances between new nations. Minor bulks in many ways is kind of insulated to that kind of thing because it allows us such optionality. Trade routes will change. Minor bulks make up 40% of dry bulk trade. So we have space to play around there rather than the bigger, say, Capesize vessels. So I think it's a mix of the three, your inherent resilience, your focused resilience, and then obviously your focused de-risk measures.
Mm-hmm. Gunnar?
I think similar answer from me. I mean, we have our company, we have fixed out our vessels on long contracts. So building, we have fixed out our fleet on a relatively long duration. So build a strong balance sheet. And But on the geopolitical, or I don't know if you can consider it geopolitical, but like there's a little bit more tension between Europe and China on a lot of EV exports from China to Europe. So there's quite a lot of talk about that now. Again, we are not so exposed on that, given that we have fixed out our fleet long term. And we think maybe that is a little bit overblown. I mean, German car manufacturers have a substantial profit, substantial part of their profits from operations in China. And Chinese car manufacturers have a huge cost advantage over European manufacturers. So we think that trend is something that will remain. Car sales pre-COVID, sales are just recovering now to pre-COVID level, but exports out of the Far East, which is really what is driving the demand for seaborne transportation of cars, is up 50%, around about 50% compared to pre-COVID. So we believe these European tensions are not. But then, of course, as we have covered, there's a lot of other things going on in the world.
Yeah.
Red Sea, increasing tensions now. René mentioned this MSC vessel, which is a totally new area, a trade lane. So, of course, that's very concerning. And with potentially Donald Trump in the White House again, I mean, who knows what can happen.
So we only have very little time left. I'll just ask one final question. What's on your radar going forward? Maybe we want to start with Ashima?
Sure. I think, you know, looking ahead, for us, the two things that we'll see in the maritime industry, so we do see that there is a really low order book. Shipbuilding capacity is really at a all-time low. It's 40% down versus a decade ago. And with the order book so constrained and tonnage demand increasing over the next decade, we do think that this could place upward pressure on freight rates. And, you know, we're constantly assessing on what that means for our business, as it will involve, you know, strong price risk management to manage that volatility that comes. On a second note, given that I do look at decarbonization in the shipping space at BHP, we do think that what could really be a potential disruptor, and to Marco's point on the regulations being quite fragmented, if there is a push for a global carbon pricing mechanism, this could really motivate and usher in financing of shipbuilding that is geared towards zero and low emissions and could really transform the shipping industry. So, you know, we're actively looking. IMO, first steps taken over the last year. But, you know, we would be a proponent of, you know, a carbon pricing mechanism that works globally.
Yeah. Anyone else?
I'm happy to repeat again. You know, I think what is on our radar is trade patterns, security situation, and climate change. That is on the top of our agenda. And then, just on a final comment, and I alluded to it early on, this industry has been around for a long while. The company I work with was established in 1904. We have experienced two world wars, and I don't know how many conflicts around the world. We are, as an industry, a part of the solution. We are not a part of the problem. So I think if I can end on that happy note, thank you.
All right. We've still got one minute left.
last word.
Go on.
Please, everybody, just do not stop at reading the news for what it is. There is always more behind it than what you read. You know, you look at some statistics, and everybody says it's so happy. I was looking at something the other day that China, inevitably, it is the fastest growing market for electric cars. Then you see this graph, this chart going up. Oh, great. So China is converting to electric cars. Then you overlap to that the electric production of China through coal plants. It's the equivalent graph trend going up on a parallel side. So, you know, okay, we have a lot of electric cars, but then we're producing electricity by burning coal. Is that a solution? So let's not stop to the first thing. I'm asking everybody, let's dig deeper into the problems. Let's not be superficial and take what we get fed every day.
Right. I think we'll end there. So I'd like to thank the panel very much for all your insight and the audience for listening. And we hope you've had some good takeaways from that.